Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff. Today we're going to talk about a very difficult subject. Caregiving is not easy. People often talk about the job of caregiving, what it takes to do things for an individual, and also to take care of yourself. But what we're going to talk today about are the difficult emotions, the deep fears, the pain that sometimes go with caregiving, especially in an end-of-life situation or a particularly intense illness. These are the things people don't usually want to talk about. So we have two people with us today to help us with this subject. First, Eve, who's a wonderful woman who is willing to share with us the pain that she went through in her husband's final illness. And I have to tell you that it's very similar to what I went through in the end of my husband's life. The last 2 years of his life were no fun for anybody, particularly, of course, for him. But it was also a very difficult time for myself and for my six-year-old son. And it took a long time to get over that. And I think what the discussion we're going to have with Eve will hopefully give us some perspective on it. And because it was difficult for me not to just go right back into my own experience, I asked Dr. Cheryl Baker if she would speak with us about this interview and help us understand it, get some perspective on it, and learn what we can from it. Again, we're not going to criticize anything that did happen. Instead, what we're going to look at is what can we learn from this, both as a patient and as a caregiver. What can you learn to make the next experience go better? And what can you learn as just someone else observing this? When you see a friend who's going through this, either as a patient or a caregiver, what could you do to support them in getting through this whole, intact, and with their sanity? It's a very tough situation. So please stay with us, learn with us as we meet Eve and Cheryl. We'll be right back after this message. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Please read about us at our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a CD from the ones that we use on the show. And again, our website is powerfulpatient.org. So I have a woman today with me whose name is Eve, who's agreed to talk about what I know is a painful episode in her life. So we're going to talk a little bit about her husband's illness and her own role as a caregiver. So Eve, can you tell us a little bit about what happened and the progress of your husband's illness?
In 1992, my husband was finally diagnosed with von Hippel-Lindau. And had brain surgery, kidney surgery, and basically, although he did have some deficits, did really well until his last kidney had to be removed in 2001, and he went on dialysis, and after that he really went downhill pretty quickly.
Now, in the early stages of his illness, who was helping to manage it? I know sometimes people manage their illness themselves, and sometimes the spouse plays an active role. What was your role?
He was a very independent man and very much wanted to take charge of his own illness, and I was really only peripherally involved. He really wanted to manage his care himself. So he was not very responsive to letting me take a very large role in helping him in any way, shape, or form that way.
So his illnesses, he would have surgery once in a while, and then there was a recovery period. How did you find that changed the dynamics between the two of you in the house?
Let me think. He really, as the illness progressed, became more and more within himself. He very much wanted to be in control of himself, his illness, etc.
And did he let you help him in the appropriate ways, or did he resist your help?
He really resisted my help, both emotionally, physically, spiritually, whatever. He really withdrew into himself increasingly as it went on.
And yet you were having to take on more because, of course, he was out of it in the hospital, unable to just write the checks or whatever he was normally doing, even taking out the trash. I mean, you wind up taking on more responsibility just because you have to, right?
Well, that's true. But the larger responsibilities he did not want to give up, to the point where he would pay things in advance so that the checks were taken care of, et cetera, et cetera. He was someone who put his business all in order, and that's how he wanted to proceed at all times.
Right, and he was a high-powered professional, and he maintained his role in the workforce.
Yes, that was the most important thing to him, to be a provider for his family. And even as his illness progressed, that was the thing that became the most important thing for him to do, to continue that relationship and that ability.
Right. Sometimes work becomes therapy and becomes a place to hide out.
And it was. There was a very different behavior pattern toward the end in his personality between the way he dealt with his family and the way he dealt with the people that he dealt with professionally.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it was an interesting dichotomy because he was very open to his company about his illness, and they were very aware of the situation, and actually they were quite supportive, which was quite wonderful. And but at the same time, he reserved his enthusiasm and his real spark for dealing with the people that he came into contact with professionally. You could just see it was almost a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of thing.
So when he came home, it was like he'd already given it all at the office?
Exactly.
That's a tough situation to be in, for the children as well as for you.
Well, the children at the time were grown, so they saw a whole lot less of it than I did. But I'm sure in their own ways it was very frustrating to them too, to see their father slowly deteriorating and yet being unable to make some of the connections that they, I'm sure, wanted to make.
So when would you say you really became a caregiver in that sense of really providing some material support for his condition?
Actually, as soon as he went on to dialysis, I became very aware of the need for me to step up in a physical sense, because he seemed to tolerate the dialysis very well for the first 6 months or so, and then it became less and less effective. And he also had a lot of peripheral neuropathy, which meant that a lot of the feeling in his body was not there anymore, and ultimately he had to give up driving, so it meant taking him back and forth to dialysis as well as to medical appointments, etc., etc. So that's really when it happened. It was really in the last year and a half of his life.
So that must have been pretty upsetting to him.
It was. And in fact, I didn't even realize the extent to which this was progressing, and only after he passed away did some of the people that he worked with bring up incidences where actually he'd had some small accidents with the car, etc., and that he'd been sort of encouraged to give up driving. And I never knew any of this until ultimately it became obvious to the family that this was just not going to work anymore.
So he was hiding it from you, trying to maintain his role as chief of the family?
Yeah, and the man had just an innate, a real dignity. He was a very dignified person. I think that's the only word that comes to mind. And I think that was the hardest thing for him to give up, was this sense of personal dignity.
So, but that must have been very hard for you to realize that you were being closed out in a certain sense.
Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. I think that was probably the hardest thing about his entire illness, was this feeling of not being able to help and not being wanted to be included for whatever reason in the process.
Did you try to negotiate that with him to some extent?
Oh, absolutely. I tried in every way, shape, or form that I could, but he really refused any sort of help. He wanted to do it on his own, the way he wanted to do it, and that was sort of the end of it.
A lot of people are raised with this sort of stiff upper lip mentality. You know, you need to brave it through and do whatever you can to protect the other people. But you're saying that you found that very hurtful.
It was very hurtful. And, you know, in each of us, we are who we are, largely, certainly because of the way we were brought up, as well as our own innate personality. In his case, it was really extreme in both his upbringing and also in his demeanor as an adult. And it really was simply a wall that refused to be broken down.
So, and you had your own upbringing behind you, and when he needed you, you wanted to be there for him. So it sounds like there's a real clash of agendas here.
There is a real clash of agendas there. I think it was exacerbated in my case because I was brought up to be a caregiver, as many women are, but regardless of sex, it was part of my childhood and my upbringing, and you know, it was just what I needed to do, and I was unable to perform that function really to anybody's satisfaction, particularly my own. And yes, it was hurtful, it was frustrating, and there was a lot of anger and sorrow there.
I'm hearing anger and sorrow and a little guilt in there too.
Lots of guilt. You bet.
It's sort of self-imposed, I'm sure, because it certainly didn't come from your husband. I mean, he wanted to protect you. He thought he was protecting you, and yet not realizing that he was actually hurting you.
But that's hard, because when you're in a relationship with another human being, there you want there to be a partnership, and there was no way that he would allow me to be his partner in any way. Dealing with his illness, and that was incredibly hurtful. And yet you always think, well, what could I have done? What should I have done? You know, in terms of taking care of him and also in taking care of me. So yes, there's a lot of guilt there.
Interesting that he formed more of a partnership with his colleagues at work in a certain sense than you're describing at home.
It was much easier for my husband to perform intellectually than it was for him to perform emotionally. And so this was, in retrospect, a very natural way of him to form that partnership and not the other.
So there was a business requirement for him to explain his absences and make backup plans, but at home he could try to avoid that.
Exactly.
That's interesting. Yeah, and you said the children were mostly out of the house, so they weren't as much affected by this?
No, they were grown and had mates of their own. So, you know, but they were in the house a lot toward the end. They were both living in the area toward the end, and so they were certainly aware of his deterioration. There's no doubt about that.
Now, as this went on and he got weaker on the dialysis, did he begin to make provision for you should understand the finances or the bookkeeping or any of that?
In that way, he had always been very, again, the businessman, the intellectual, he'd always been very open with his family and myself included as to our financial situation and making provisions, et cetera, et cetera. He had always been the one to take care of the finances. Toward the very end, in the very last couple of months, I noticed that he was kind of slipping mentally in having the energy to take care of some of the check writing, etc. And I took that over a little bit. It was kind of a natural progression. So that's how it happened.
And he did let that happen at that point.
I'm not even sure he was really aware of it, in a sense, at the very end, that I was, you know, opening up the bills and sending the checks.
Oftentimes women are left not knowing even how the finances work in a household, because the husband's taking care of all that. Or the reverse.
No, in that way, he was very generous with his time and his energy in making sure that the family was very well aware of the situation. He was very, very upfront, very matter of fact about life, and so this was an easy thing, if you will, for him to be matter of fact about. So in that way, we were quite well prepared.
As you can see, life is changing radically, both for Eve and for her husband, and the relationship is also shifting. The roles and responsibilities and the dynamics in the family. We'll be back after this message to talk some more with Eve. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find there the handout that goes with this show, with information about the people we've spoken with, the websites that we've mentioned, and other background information of interest on this topic. And as always, we would appreciate your support. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back now talking with Eve about her experience as a caregiver. When we're in the middle of a situation like this, it's almost impossible to see your way out of it. Did you ever get any counseling or any support that would have helped you see your way out of the cycle?
I did. In the last few months of his life, I actually did go to a weekly session with a psychologist. I had an enormous amount of anger, fear, worry, etc. And the psychologist was very helpful to me in that way.
And did he ever get any support?
He refused.
But you did try to get him to go?
I tried to get him to go for many years. He didn't believe in it. He said it wouldn't be something he was going to do, and we had many, many battles about it, because I think it would have helped our marriage. It would have helped him personally, and it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, men who grew up in the 50s were taught that you don't need a psychiatrist unless you're sick, and I think the younger men these days are a little bit more open to knowing that sometimes we just need a third person to help get some of those thoughts outside of ourselves, get a little perspective on them, and sometimes just opening that box is very helpful just in itself.
Well, I do know that I found it. It really was a lifesaver for me, because I was in terrible shape in the last few months of his life, and it was a wonderful outlet to me, because it's something that I would suggest to anyone, whether it be a psychologist or a member of the clergy, if you are religiously involved, or any kind of a counselor, a dear friend that you could totally pour your heart out to, but somebody who needed to be objective. I just think that's something that I strongly suggest to everyone.
Right. Somebody you don't have to look at over breakfast is the way I heard someone once describe it, you know. So sometimes it's good to rent a friend, just so that you don't have anyone too close, that and you can pour out all that heartache that you don't want to share with anyone who really knows you too very well.
That's true. And you also you can't share it all with your family, because they're going through their own individual reactions and fears and guilt feelings and worries and et cetera, et cetera. So it really needs to be someone who can be objective about it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your sharing this. Is there anything else that you would want to say to somebody who's sort of caught up in this vortex right now? And how can you try to negotiate with a spouse? What if you'd been able to? What ideally would have helped this situation?
I think one of the things that would have helped my situation is if I'd realized that I needed to take care of myself instead of trying to take care of him all the time. I think it would have mollified the situation greatly, and I think it would have been a better result for everyone. I do.
And you've done a lot of healing since he passed away.
I have. And I am at a point in my life where I would like to help others heal for that very reason. And to help people realize that they're not in it alone, that there are steps that they can take care of to help themselves, and that isn't a negative, that it's important for us to take care of ourselves as well as to take care of the person who is ill, and that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
And I think it's important for everybody to know, too, that there's no perfect way for anybody to handle this, that almost everybody who goes through this kind of situation winds up with those feelings, the guilt, the anger, the whole ball of wax, and it's just part of the process, and we need to somehow work our way through it.
You're right, Joyce, and I think shows like this, these radio shows that you're doing, are really helpful to help people understand the whole dynamic of chronic illness.
Is there anything you would say to other people, anything that outsiders might have been able to do to assist you at this time?
One of the greatest frustrations that I had when dealing with my husband's illness was that when you would meet someone who knew you both, that person would always ask, "How is he doing?" And no one ever said to me, "And how are you doing?" And that really hurts.
Again, there's no right, there's no wrong, but at least knowing that your pain is acknowledged by the people around you is very helpful. Just a hug, a squeeze of the hand, some human interaction that says, "I hear you, I'm so glad you're here, and I care about you." I asked Dr. Cheryl Baker if she would listen to this interview and then talk with us about it to help us learn from this experience.
I have with me Cheryl Baker. And Cheryl, would you introduce yourself to us, please?
Sure. I am Executive Director of the Life Center of the Suncoast in Tampa, Florida. For the last 25 years, I have been Director and Licensed Mental Health Counselor with an agency that has provided basically free grief counseling and working with people with chronic and serious illness, dealing with the losses, the grief that goes on in those situations. And we've served over 55,000 people at this point.
Wow.
We've been in existence since 1981.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for the wonderful service that you do. And I asked Cheryl if she would listen to my conversation with Eve and talk with us a little bit about it, because there are elements of grief in that conversation as well as in the caregiving aspects of it.
Definitely.
So tell me your impressions.
Well, I was very aware, as is very common, the sense of how the relationship and that the relationship changes. And that in and of itself, in whatever way, based on a person's personal life history with the loved one, becomes loss in some way. Mm-hmm. I think that when people have a history, a loving history with someone, that person becomes a mirror in a way to mirror all of the emotions that a relationship brings up. And when that mirror cracks, or shatters through a death or a separation, or certainly in this case an illness, a severe illness, there is definitely a sense of some part of oneself has died. Mm-hmm. And that may be an instant recognition, or it could be subtly along the way that, I can no longer communicate in the same ways that I used to in terms of my relationship.
Right, and there's a big change going on for three components here, for the husband, for the wife, and for the relationship.
And for any other family members around them.
Correct. So for the husband, in this case the patient, he had always seen himself as vigorous, the breadwinner, the head of the family, and quite a high-powered guy. And to be brought low by a disease means that he has to grieve the change in his own persona.
And he may carry that heavily in his heart all the way through the illness sometimes. Sometimes, people will withdraw because the pressure and the pain or the need for denial is really the attempt for the person to shut down and to resist the flooding that goes on when you're first diagnosed and as the symptoms increase. And denial and even withdrawing is a buffer zone that helps people kind of come to it over time. Denial cracks many different ways when we have physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
But the loss of what you just said, the loss of the person, the roles and the changing of just their personality sometimes, that becomes very accumulated for both the person going through it, because it's the loss in a sense of a betrayal of their own body.
And when someone feels that weakness, that almost shame that they're sick and not who they used to be, sometimes that turns into anger or it gets lashed out at other people around them.
It sure can, and it can be turned inward as bitterness, or I just can't talk about it, it's too much. And that becomes a very isolated wall, a one-sided wall, that's very hard to penetrate for the caregiver.
Right. And the dynamics in the marriage begin to shift because the roles and responsibilities may need to change.
Yeah, there's certainly a change in the partnership. And if people have an underlying deep core of love, that may carry them through to have that remembrance of the best parts of the person that are still somewhere inside, even if they're not apparent. They're not observed, they're not experienced, but people begin to rely on past memory. In a sense, we remember the good moments, and then we're thrown back into the present moment, which might be full of pain or just survival, physical survival.
Do you find that it works better if people are able to talk about it together and process it and try to work it out?
Yes, if that's possible. And you need two people to say yes to that.
Right.
But it's certainly the more communication. And there was a wonderful psychologist, Dr. Ken Pelletier, who years ago talked about recovery characteristics through loss and illness. And he said a couple of things, that the determinants were the primary determinant of being well in a difficult or illness situation is social support. So if you don't have that from the person, your partner, that in networking becomes much more important around people. If you don't have a person who is ill who is going to communicate with you, it's very important to have some social support, some wonderful groups like you have through the Family Alliance.
Yes, and in this particular situation, it sounded as though her husband was reaching more toward his colleagues at work mm-hmm. than he was toward his wife and children.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of things affect that?
Well, it certainly would be easier to do that. It's the known. It's the place where he still has a remnants part of himself that's functioning okay,
mm-hmm.
and until that begins to change. But it leaves very little to bring home. Because I would imagine just to keep that going takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so when he
right.
came home, there isn't much left, and that's what I heard. There wasn't really very little, from what she described, very little left to have for the home front, for the simple things to just enjoy an evening together. And that, too, points to when it's the things that are the toughest for us to deal with. We kind of close down.
So there was a business requirement for him to share something at work because obviously he wasn't going to be able to meet all his business objectives at work, and he needed the support of his colleagues. So you can almost say he was forced into opening up to a certain extent at work, and then expended a lot of energy pretending to be Mr. Cool and being strong and all that sort of thing. And then, as you say, that spends all his energy, and by the time he gets home, he doesn't have anything else left to give.
It's very exhausting. And yet for him, perhaps that was the place where he felt most alive.
Right.
You know, so it's not a judgment about that it's wrong or right.
Right.
It has a profound, difficult effect on the caregivers.
Right. And sometimes going to work becomes a place to escape to because, mm-hmm. as you say, you can get your mind wrapped around the business things that you have to take care of and kind of forget that you're not well.
Yeah. And you know, that's, I remember with the TV interview with Ted Koppel and Tuesdays with Maury. When he could still be a teacher, his voice changed. He was able to draw a certain inner strength that came from him in a particular way, and then he would be very exhausted right after.
Mm.
And I think that you know, people store what they need, and it's what's most helps them be alive. And whether it's working through or it's denying the illness part of themselves, it's still a coping mechanism.
We're speaking with Dr. Cheryl Baker of the Life Center of Suncoast in Tampa, Florida. We'll be back to talk some more with Dr. Baker in just a moment. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
We're back now talking with Dr. Cheryl Baker.
There's a need for objectivity, and what she spoke of at the end, it's a need to talk to someone because she didn't have that with her partner as he was failing in his illness.
Right. And sometimes you feel you can open up to a friend or something, and sometimes you don't feel that you can.
Well, and that's, you know, that's where either a website or a chat room or a site like your organization where people that can't even get out of the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we say support groups are great, but you have to be able to get to them.
Right. So it could be that you could find a live group and go and gather with a group of people at a hospital or an agency where you can talk it out in the open one-on-one. But as you say, if you can't do that, then some other medium might be more convenient, either the telephone or the Internet.
Yeah, the Internet seems very helpful for folks that are dealing with grief. They can't sleep at night. They get into a chat room. And they look up the particular, you know, situation like this disease, mm-hmm. and they find somebody in California 5-4 hours earlier, perhaps.
Or in Europe.
Yeah, in Europe, that can go, yes, I know what you're talking about. And in the wee hours, they might form a bond with that person that becomes their social network. And that they've experienced perhaps some self-compassion, which is what is so very necessary, because I think there's the tendency to either criticize ourselves for not being a better caregiver,
sure.
better wife, better friend, and there's the part in ourselves as a caregiver that when we don't get that communication from a loved one, we shut down.
Yes, absolutely. And the other thing I just wanted to say about the support groups, some of those give you a greater degree of anonymity, and depending what's going on and depending how much you want to scream and rail or whatever and get some of this out of your gut, sometimes it's very helpful to be anonymous.
And another way that we have found really helpful with years and years of people who have gone through loss, that even if you're not a writer or an artist, that some creative expression, it helps look at, you know, bring out what our mind and our hearts are trying to make a connection between the fact of what's going on and the feeling of what's going on. And that journaling has helped thousands of people just look at what are my mental distortions, what are my, what's the rage I feel inside that I can't share with my loved one, you know,
that's
who might
right.
be dying.
Right.
And then to feel guilty for having those feelings. We then self-criticize, self-punish. We don't believe we deserve, in a way, that care for ourselves. And so you have a lot of neglect of physical and emotional needs of the caregiver because they almost disappear in the disease.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more about the caregiver. I mean, as you say, I see not only a very intense effort to try to be helpful, and that's not always accepted. Sometimes it is accepted, but other times it's rejected or it's met with, I'm really okay, or I gave it the office. So that kind of rebuff is very painful.
Resentment sometimes of being dependent.
Yeah, I don't need your pity.
Yeah.
Various kinds of negative reactions. That leaves the caregiver with a lot of love that they want to share and nobody to take it.
Exactly.
So that's a lot of pain right there. Another piece is that when the caregiver confronts this kind of a situation, especially if it's your spouse, there's a loss for you. There's a loss of the person he used to be.
Yes.
And a huge change in your own life. Oh, you know, what made my life turn out this way? What did I do wrong that made my life turn out this way?
And it's that why me part of that grieving process that can come out either very subtly or very aggressively, you mm-hmm. know, that this isn't fair. And as you said, the loss of the expectations that it would turn out differently.
Right.
And then it begins to erode at the caregiver's self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
their confidence, their trust of themselves as well as their partner, because the roles are changing, as you previously said.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is then the work on oneself to be that person inside to say, what are my greatest fears right now? I'm facing the present moment of the losses, and I'm also having what Dr. Kubler-Ross talked about as anticipatory grief.
Worrying that my husband's about to die.
Loss of future.
How is that going to affect my life, my children's lives, my financial future?
Oh,
all
yes.
that comes up.
Absolutely. And that's where it's good to have that objectivity of someone to share that with, some agency, you know, that can provide just clear information,
mm-hmm.
and to help them based on, you know, what are the financial needs, what are the emotional needs, the insurance issues that go on. And those are the material, technical, you know, at the top issues, but then you have the emotional ones of facing my own fears
mm-hmm.
of how will I be able to take over. And that's also still bringing the future about, you know, in front of oneself. But it's about beginning to face what are the changes within me? Because there is some beauty somewhere buried deep inside of what I have learned is the resilience
mm-hmm.
in people. And there is resilience in sometimes the most darkest, most devastating abyss, you know, that people
right.
walk into, and what do they come out as? And sometimes it's just the ability to grieve, to let go, to breathe out the sorrow in the middle of not knowing what to do. It's deep breathing. Sometimes we work with that. We
mm-hmm.
have people tell me that they do exercise or yoga or ways to just be still with breathing out their fears and their pain. And beginning to look at what's the compassion for myself right now, as well as the person that I'm loving and seen them go through such loss.
Right, and that it's perfectly okay to take care of yourself even in the face of someone else's very devastating illness. While you need to be there for your friend or your spouse, you also have to be there for yourself.
Yes, absolutely. And because you can only, you know, it's kind of like the oxygen mask down on yourself first,
right,
in the airplane, and then for the people around you.
Right, because if you pass out, what good are you?
Exactly. Exactly, and that's so hard for so many people who are born caregivers.
Right.
And so many women, more generally, I've seen and experienced around me, that are born caregivers. And so it's to deal with that guilt, to go through the guilt and say, mm-hmm, and equally, I need to have my needs, some of my needs, begin to be alive, aware of what can I do in the situation. And it begins to, in a way, you're still loving that person you're taking care of, but it's not everything dependent upon them.
Right, and you also need to have some stimulation. I mean, being in a sick room kind of atmosphere all the time is not a pleasant experience.
No.
And you really need to refresh yourself so that you can go back and be okay being there and not just come to resent it.
And some of that refreshment that you talked about is a great word, might be just walking outside for a breath of fresh air.
Right.
If you can't have, you know, you can't leave a person alone,
right,
or to get some people that could span, mm-hmm, so that you do get out and take time to just do something that feels really even frivolous, it would be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, get your nails done.
Right, get your nails done is a good suggestion. Mm-hmm. But no, seriously, find something that you would find refreshing and renewing. We need to recharge our batteries in whatever way that is. And some people need to be with other people in order to recharge their batteries, and some people need quiet time.
And we're talking about releasing stress.
Mm-hmm.
And for some, that would be a massage. For some, mm-hmm, what is their way of releasing mental tension?
Mm-hmm.
It might be going to a football game. It might be screaming at the top of your lungs at a sports event. It might be self-nurturing with taking a warm, wonderful bath with candles all around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that self-awareness that you're in touch with the changes that are happening in your reality. And you observe your own feelings that go with that. And if you can observe them without judging them, and that's the tough one, and that's sometimes why we need an objective buddy, friend, counselor, whatever, to return to your own heart that really says, I'm still breathing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm breathing through my heartbeat right now, and I can have some ability to still celebrate my aliveness through the changes, through the losses.
We'll be back in just a moment to speak some more with Dr. Cheryl Baker. Don't forget to go to the website at powerfulpatient.org, pick up the handout that goes with this show, and of course we would always appreciate your contribution to support the show and the work of the Cancer Research Fund. We're in the process of choosing this year's grant recipients, and it would be wonderful to have your help in funding one more grant. That's powerfulpatient.org. Thank you. We're back now speaking with Dr. Cheryl Baker.
You've talked a lot about breathing. Tell us some more about that, because I think I've observed, too, that when people are under a lot of stress, they almost forget to breathe, or they begin to breathe very shallowly. They don't get the same kind of cleansing breath that we should be getting.
Well, under stress, under trauma, people have very shallow breathing, as you mentioned, because it goes to a part of the brain that's that fight or flight response.
Hmm.
Which means the adrenals don't just shut off because the danger is over. It's almost like a continual low-grade kind of excitement or anxiety, is how people usually describe it,
mm-hmm,
that is a part of them, that they're always on call. And that was something we haven't talked about, the sense of on-callness. that has a physiological, you know, response, which we see in people with post-trauma after losses, little losses and big losses. And that fight-or-flight response is a built-in mechanism to help us get through danger. But when it's low-grade, when it's chronic, it can really take a toll on our physical. That's why people talk about feeling much more fatigued, even if they've had a night's sleep. And it takes a toll on our emotional and mental status. So we look at what is the antidote, what are the ways we can calm ourselves. And breathing is our first line of defense right there. It's the first thing that happens to us when we wake up, when we're born, and it's the last thing that goes as we die. And so the idea of bringing in just very gentle self-affirming or compassion is one of the ways I see it. Breathing in compassion in my mental, what that means to me, it would be different than what it means to you. Mm-hmm. And breathing out my fear, exhaling out some of the sorrow, the sadness, the grief. There's mm-hmm. a wonderful tape by Dr. Andrew Weil. Mm-hmm. And he is a University of Tucson medical director, and he has a lot of public TV programs and, right. and wonderful books. And he has a just a tape and a, or a CD called Breathing. And it's different breathing techniques. And, you know, I can share one of them if you would like, very simply.
Okay.
If that feels sure. appropriate. At the Life Center, we often support people with whatever kind of deep breathing. If they already do it, that's fine. My very simple way of looking at it is breathing in a count of three or four, holding for that same amount, before taking a space before I breathe out. And the breath out is elongated, and it's double the breathing count of the inhale. So if you're breathing in for three breaths, you're holding for three breaths, you're breathing out six breaths.
Okay. So that's a little first aid for some high anxiety. Wherever you are, mm-hmm. you can just sit there. If you're, as long as you're not driving a car, don't do this when you're driving a car. But
yeah, unless you're stopped.
Right. But just sit quietly, maybe close your eyes, and focus on your breathing. And breathe with the rhythm that she just suggested. In for a count of three, hold for a count of three, and then out slowly for a count of six. Mm-hmm. And that's a good way to just center yourself down. There are lots of different things that use breathing techniques. I know I learned
exactly.
Lamaze breathing when I had a baby in the 1970s. That was my first exposure to it.
Yes.
There's mindful meditation breathing kind of things from Jon Kabat-Zinn or Joan Borisenko.
Yes.
And Dr. Weil has a tape as well. So, but that's a good place to start.
It's a reminder.
Yeah.
You know, we all know these things. There's nothing that we really don't, you know, somebody might have said a long time ago, but when we're under stress or duress, we forget, and it's wonderful to have very simple reminders. Oh, I can do that.
Yes. Just take a deep breath, and that in itself is pretty amazing.
Yes.
The change that it'll make, it kind of reminds you to breathe again. And it sounds silly sometimes to say that, but if you've been under heavy tension, you probably recognize that when we say it, that you really need to remind yourself to breathe, and that's the first way to take care of yourself.
And when you are counting, it sounds silly, but when you're counting, you can't be in the past and you can't be in the future. So it keeps one very, very present just in these 30 seconds
mm-hmm.
that I'm taking a pause.
The other thing that I've observed is that when people hold their stresses, their anxieties, their angers and resentments, when they hold that inside themselves, it becomes very corrosive. It becomes almost like a poison. But somehow, if you, through some mechanism, can get that out of yourself, you can get more perspective on it. And you can also try to reduce the poisonous component of it. Get it out there where you can examine it critically and really try to make it dissipate.
And it's being, you know, present for oneself. If all you have is 2 minutes just to walk outside, to look at the clouds, to hear the birds, to take that moment that is just, you know, there is life. There is life within me. There's life around me. Mm-hmm. And then I can bring that back into the sick room, the bedroom, the
right.
place where, you know, there is that sense of change going on. And sometimes it helps one see the beauty that's still inside the soul of that person that's ill.
Uh-huh.
You know, that there's something more going on than just this block, this wall, this, you know, this illness that's between us like an elephant in a room.
That's a very interesting point. Tell me some more about that. So if there, frequently when we get into a bad situation like this, you'll get into some possibly very silly sounding argument, and yet it becomes very difficult to let go of, and it just kind of escalates. It becomes the thing that we can fight over, but it may not even be relevant. And how does one break out of one of those things? And
that's, you know, it's difficult, because we all would do it a lot faster and quicker if we knew to mm-hmm. just pay attention sometimes that this isn't the reality. You know, we're having this fight over whatever it is. And
I don't know, you borrowed my keys, or, you know, some stupid thing like this. And
and
in fact, that's not what it is at all. It's really, I'm really in distress because I'm losing you.
Losing, and I'm also, it's that, what we talked about earlier, that disappointment that you can't still be in the same role that I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
And that forces me to change my role. I have to all of a sudden be more vigilant, more responsible, one more thing, which can be very, very overwhelming at times. So I think, you know, that's working inside. But to go back to the question, I think it's the awareness that we're you know, here's this argument. If you can just pull out of it for a minute, you go back to your breath.
Right.
You walk out of the room for 30 seconds or a minute. Say, I have to go for a second. I will be back in a minute. And just pay attention with, oh my God, my heart's racing. You know, my jaw's tight. So first you're aware of where the stresses are in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very it becomes very physiological. People talk about the fist in their gut, in their stomach, butterflies, tension. And again, it's breathing through that constriction
mm-hmm.
that anger makes us feel. Anger is very constricting. And so if I can take that moment, have that awareness and say, you know, in a good moment, because mm-hmm. it doesn't happen right away, it might go through 10 different times, and you have to be gentle on yourself that I'm not being objective. Okay, you know, you'll get another opportunity. But there's that one moment finally that you break through and say, this isn't really the issue here.
You know, right.
It's not about the keys or the food he ate or the mess that was created. It's really, it's about, here's one more insult to our relationship.
Hmm.
And if you can see that as a couple, that light can go off. That light bulb can go off inside and go, there's more than just you and me here. You know, what's the awareness right now that brings us to maybe a moment of my heart to your heart. This is heavy, this is hard, and we just can embrace for a moment and break through that wall, you know, that you might have very brief right. moments of that ability. And if you don't have that ability, it's still maybe going back in the room a moment later and just touching his hand. And there might even be that need to come through in our egos and go, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sorry for my short-temperedness. Because the caregiver's emotional tolerance gets very strained,
mm-hmm.
as you know.
Right. And it would be nice if it could all turn out like in the movies, you know, like in Love Story or some of the other movies where the couple has these loving conversations about, oh, well, you know, after I'm gone, I hope you'll get married again because I want you to be happy. But the reality is those conversations don't always occur.
Probably they occur much more rare.
Yeah, right. And as much as the caregiver is fearing how her life is going to change, or his or her life is going to change with the loss of this loved one, the person who's dying is going to lose everybody.
Yes. Yes.
And the preparation for that is sometimes, some people react to it in different ways, but I know some people have closed themselves off, almost like a preparation for, I'm going to lose it anyway, so I might as well do it now, you know.
Yes, and that's a very, that can happen. It's certainly a coping mechanism.
Which compounds the hurt for the caregiver.
It compounds the hurt for the caregiver, and it takes a deep understanding. You know, we say, oh, well, it's not personal, but it sure feels personal.
Yep.
You know, I wouldn't say it to someone anymore to say, oh, well, but you know it's really not personal, because it attacks the deepest core of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there is probably, for a lot of people, knowing that your loved one is perhaps imminently dying, you know, you want to take care of as much unfinishedness as possible. And sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes the person's mind is hallucinating, or they're on pain medication, or they have tumors that have affected their ability to think. And so the person is, again, they're grieving, the caregiver is grieving all of these things along the way, and there are still those moments that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had taught many years ago about coming to some peace. You know, we bargain, we look for if-onlys and what-ifs, and that happens before someone dies, and it certainly happens after someone dies.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a tendency for a lot of people, is the caregiver part, to try to at least get some closure before the person dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean just simply, I love you. You know, I know that the disease is talking through you sometimes, and I still have love for you. And, you know, if we can find some moments of peace that are way beyond any understanding or psychological framework,
mm-hmm.
it's that kind of ability to get through it and to say goodbye before death really occurs.
In a couple of cases I've seen where toward the end the person who's dying almost becomes paranoid and almost turns on the caregiver and says that, I think you're trying to kill me, or, you know, what is that medicine you're trying to give me, or something like that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and that's a really tough one.
Well, and that's where it's so important to get an outside helpful person, a buddy, a friend, somebody else who can witness what you're going through,
mm-hmm.
and then witness the release of that emotionally and verbally is so very important.
And somebody to remind the caregiver that they're really doing the best they can, and
yes.
It's okay. And if you aren't 100%, hey, who is? You know, all those things, get a little bit more objectivity on it.
Well, and that's so very important if people have that, and that's why sometimes the internet ability is the best ability if you can't get to a meeting or you know, have a friend to go to in those situations.
Right. Well, thank you. This has been very, very helpful.
Well, you're very welcome, and I hope, you know, some things have been said and that are helpful to people.
Yeah.
And that people seek support for themselves,
right,
and self-nurturing in whatever ways that they can.
Right, and as you said, a journal can be helpful, and even after someone dies, you can write them a letter or something and say whatever you didn't think you were able to say.
And I think that that's the most important piece that you just said, too, that it's, even if it can't be finished before a person dies, that the grieving afterwards can allow for great healing as well, because we can release things sometimes that we couldn't do with the person.
Right.
And healing does occur. I mean, I see it every day in the resilience of people that have lost someone in sudden death, where they don't have time at all to have the loss in front of them. It's always behind them. And so in that ability, that grief and saying goodbye happens certainly after death. And it's very realistic that it can happen, and that people don't get down on themselves if they can't do that while the person's still alive.
And we need them all to be well and go ahead and live after their loved one dies, because they have a lot of good stuff ahead of them. It's not kind of hard to see that when you're in it. But
it's very hard to see it when you're in it. But you know,
like life is a roller coaster. This is about the time on the roller coaster that it's speeding downward and you think you're about to crash and die. Then it turns up, and it's this nice, lovely, slow rise to the top and a pretty view. Yeah. And there is stuff out there, but it may take a while to heal it, but work at it. It's there.
And one more thing, the idea of people like yourself, Joyce, that really can show the survivorship of it and that life does go on beyond being a caregiver once that role is released, and there's a lot of loss in now what do I do after a death occurs.
Right.
But you and people like yourself are the people that are that beacon of light that people can go towards.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. It's been very helpful to speak with you. And to all those caregivers out there who are struggling with this situation or who have struggled with it in the past, I want you to know you've done the best you can, and you're great, and we're right there with you. And please reach out. Find a buddy to do it, or call the Powerful Patient, or write to us. Join an online support group. We'll put some pointers for you in the handout that goes with this show on the Powerful Patient website. Next week, we're going to speak with Dr. Shepard Kaminars about journal writing and how writing a journal can help you to get perspective on difficult situations that you may be dealing with in your life. So please join us next week, and meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.